The letter looked like it had come out of a laser printer. There were no other markings on the page other than the two creases from where it had been folded. I sat back down. "Did you keep the envelope it came in?" I asked. "Yes," Stanton said. "No return address and the postmark is Hollywood. I'm going to have the sheriff's lab take a look at the note and the envelope." "Judge, I hope you haven't spoken to this juror," Golnitz said. "We should be present and part of any questioning. This could just be a ploy by someone to get that juror off the panel." I expected Golnitz to rush to the juror's defense. As far as he was concerned, number 7 was a blue juror. I rushed to my own defense. "He's talking about this being a ploy by the defense, and I object to the accusation." The judge quickly held his hands up in a calming gesture. "Just hold your horses, both of you. I didn't talk to number 7 yet. I spent the weekend thinking about how to proceed with it when I came to court today. I conferred with a few other judges on the matter, and I was fully prepared to bring it up with counsel present this morning. The only problem is, juror number 7 didn't show up today. He's not here." That brought a pause to both Golnitz and me. "He's not here," Golnitz said. "Did you send deputies to—"
"Yes, I sent court deputies to his home, and his wife told them that he was at work, but she didn't know anything about court or a trial or anything like that. They went over to Lockheed and found the man and brought him here a few minutes ago. It wasn't him. He was not juror number 7.
"Judge, you're losing me," I said. "I thought you said they found him at work." The judge nodded.
"I know. I did. This is beginning to sound like Laurel and Hardy and that who's on first thing."
"Abbott and Costello," I said.
"What?"
"Abbott and Costello. They did the who's on first thing."
"Whichever. The point is, juror number 7 was not juror number 7.
"I'm still not following you, Judge," I said.
"We had number 7 down in the computer as Rodney L. Banglund, engineer from Lockheed, resident of Palos Verde. But the man who has been sitting for 2 weeks in seat number 7 is not Rodney Banglund. We don't know who he was, and now he's missing."
"He took Banglund's place, but Banglund didn't know about it," Golnitz said.
"Apparently," the judge said, "Banglund, the real one, is being interviewed about it now. But when he was in here, he didn't seem to know anything about this. He said he never got a jury summons in the first place."
"So his summons was sort of hijacked and used by this unknown person?" I said. The judge nodded.
"So it appears. The question is why, and the sheriff's department will hopefully get that answered."
"What does this do to the trial?" I asked. "Do we have a mistrial?"
"I don't think so. I think we bring the jury out, we explain that number 7's been excused for reasons they don't need to know about, we drop in the first alternate and go from there. Meantime, the sheriff's department quietly makes damn sure everybody else in that box is exactly who they are supposed to be. Mr. Golnitz?"
Golnitz nodded thoughtfully before speaking.
"This is all rather shocking," he said. "But I think the state would be prepared to continue. As long as we find out that this whole thing stops at juror number 7.
Mr. Haller?" I nodded my approval. The session had gone as I had hoped. "I've got witnesses from as far as Paris in town and ready to go. I don't want a mistrial. My client doesn't want a mistrial." The judge sealed the deal with a nod.
"Okay, go on back out there and we'll get this thing going in 10 minutes.
On the way down the hall to the courtroom, Golnitz whispered a threat to me. "He's not the only one who's going to investigate this, Haller."
"Yeah, what's that supposed to mean?"
"It means, when we find this bastard, we're also going to find out what he was doing on the jury. And if there is any tie to the defense, then I'm going—"
I pushed by him toward the door to the courtroom. I didn't need to listen to the rest.
"Good for you, Jeff," I said as I entered the courtroom.
I didn't see Stallworth, and hoped the deputy had gone out into the hallway as I had instructed and was waiting. Elliot was all over me when I got to the defense table.
"What happened? What's going on?"
I used my hand to signal him to keep his voice down. I then whispered to him, "Juror number 7 didn't show up today, and the judge looked into it and found out he was a phony." Elliot stiffened and looked like somebody had just pressed a letter opener 2 inches into his back.
"My God, what does this mean?"
"For us, nothing. the trial continues with an alternate juror in his place. But there will be an investigation of who number seven was, and hopefully, Walter, it doesn't come to your door.
I don't see how it could. But we can't go on now. You have to stop this. Get a mistrial.
I looked at the pleading look on my client's face and realized he'd never had any faith in his own defense. He had been counting solely on the sleeping juror. The judge said no on a mistrial. We go with what we've got. Elliot rubbed a shaking hand over his mouth.
Don't worry, Walter. You're in good hands. We're going to win this thing fair and square.
Just then, the court called the courtroom to order, and the judge bounded up the steps to the bench.
Okay, back on the record with California versus Elliot, he said. Let's bring in our jury.
The first witness for the defense was Julio Muniz, the freelance videographer from Topanga Canyon, who got the jump on the rest of the local media and arrived ahead of the pack at the Elliot house on the day of the murders. I quickly established through my questions how Muniz made his living. He worked for no network or local news channel. He listened to police scanners in his home and car and picked up addresses for crime scenes and active police situations. He responded to these scenes with his video camera and took film he then sold to the local news broadcasts that had not responded. In regard to the Elliott case, it began for him when he heard a call out for a homicide team on his scanner and went to the address with his camera.
Mr. Muniz, what did you do when you arrived there? I asked.
Well, I got my camera out and started shooting. I noticed that they had somebody in the back of the patrol car, and I thought that was probably a suspect. So I shot him, and then I shot the deputies stringing crime scene tape across the front of the property, things like that.
I then introduced the digital video cassette Muniz used that day as the first defense exhibit and rolled the video screen and player in front of the jury. I put in the cassette and hit play. It had been previously spooled to begin at the point that Muniz began shooting outside the Elliott house. As the video played, I watched the jurors paying close attention to it. I was already familiar with the video, having watched it several times. It showed Walter Elliott sitting in the back passenger seat of the patrol car. Because the video had been shot at an angle above the car, the 4A designation painted on its roof was clearly visible. The video jumped from the car to scenes of the deputies cordoning off the house and then jumped back again to the patrol car. This time, it showed Elliott being removed from the car by Detectives Kinder and Erickson. They uncuffed him and led him into the house. Using a remote, I stopped the video and rewound it back to a point where Muniz had come in close on Elliott in the back seat of the patrol car. I started the video forward again and then froze the image so the jury could see Elliott leaning forward because his hands were cuffed behind his back.
Okay, Mr. Muniz, let me draw your attention to the roof of the patrol car. What do you see painted there?
I see the car's designation painted there. It is 4A, or 4 Alpha, as they say on the sheriff's radio.
Okay, and did you recognize that designation? Had you seen it before?
Well, I listen to the scanner a lot, and so I'm familiar with the 4 Alpha designation. And I'd actually seen the 4 Alpha car earlier that day.
And what were the circumstances of that?
I had been listening to the scanner, and I heard about a hostage situation in Malibu Creek State Park. I went out to shoot that, too.
What time was this?
About 2 a.m.
So, about 10 hours before you were videoing the activities at the Elliott house, you went out to shoot video at this hostage situation, correct?
That's correct.
And the 4 Alpha car was involved also in this earlier incident?
Yes. When the suspect was finally captured, he was transported in 4 Alpha, the same car.
About what time did that occur?
That wasn't until almost 5 in the morning. It was a long night.
Did you shoot video of this?
Yes, I did. That footage comes earlier on the same tape.
He pointed to the frozen image on the screen.
Then, let's see, I said. I hit the rewind button on the remote.
Golentz immediately stood, objected, and asked for a sidebar. The judge waved us up, and I brought along the witness list I had submitted to the court 2 weeks earlier.
Your Honor, Golentz said angrily. The defense is once again sandbagging. There has been no indication in discovery or otherwise of Mr. Haller's intent to explore some other crime with this witness. I object to this being introduced.
I calmly slid the witness list in front of the judge. Under the rules of discovery, I had to list each witness I intended to call and give a brief summary of what their testimony was expected to include. Julio Muniz was on my list. The summary was brief, but all-inclusive. It clearly says he would testify about video he shot on May 2nd, the day of the murders, I said. The video he shot at the park was shot on the day of the murders, May 2. It's been on there for 2 weeks, Judge. If anybody is sandbagging, then it's Mr. Golan sandbagging himself. He could have talked to this witness and checked out his videos. He apparently didn't. The judge studied the witness list for a moment and nodded. Objection overruled, he said. You may proceed, Mr. Haller. I went back and rewound the video and started to play it. The jury continued to pay maximum interest. It was a night shoot, and the images were more grainy, and the scenes seemed to jump around more than in the first sequence. Finally, it came to footage showing a man with his hands cuffed behind his back being placed in a patrol car. A deputy closed the door and slapped the roof twice. The car drove off and came directly by the camera. As it was going by, I froze the image. The screen showed a grainy shot of the patrol car. The light of the camera illuminated the man sitting in the back seat as well as the roof of the car. Mr. Muniz, what's the designation on the roof of that car? Again, it's 4A or 4Alpha. And the man being transported, where is he sitting? In the rear right passenger seat. Is he handcuffed? Well, he was when they put him in the car. I shot it. His hands were cuffed behind his back, correct? Correct. Now, is he in the same position and seat in the patrol car that Mr. Elliott was in when you videotaped him about 8 hours later? Yes, he is. Exact same position. Thank you, Mr. Muniz. No further questions. Golance passed on cross-examination. There was nothing about the direct that could be attacked, and the video didn't lie. Muniz stepped down. I told the judge I wanted to leave the video screen in place for my next witness, and I called Deputy Todd Stallworth to the stand. Stallworth looked angrier as he came into the courtroom. This was good. He also looked beat, and his uniform looked like it had wilted on his body. One of the sleeves of his shirt had a black scuff mark on it, presumably from some struggle during the night. I quickly established Stallworth's identity, and that he was driving the Alpha car in the Malibu district during the first shift on the day of the murders in the Elliott house. Before I could ask another question, Golance once more objected and asked for another sidebar. When we got there, he raised his hands palms up in a "what's this" gesture. His style was getting old with me. Judge, I object to this witness. The defense hid him on the witness list, among the many deputies who were on the scene and have no bearing on the case. Once again, I had the witness list ready. This time, I slapped it down in front of the judge with frustration, then ran my finger down the column of names until I reached Todd Stallworth. It was there, in the middle of a list of 5 other deputies, all of whom had been on the scene at the Elliott house. Judge, if I was hiding Stallworth, I was hiding him in plain sight. He's clearly listed there under law enforcement personnel. The explanation is the same as before. It says he'll testify about his activities on May 2. That's all I put down, because I never talked to him. I'm hearing what he has to say for the first time right now. Golance shook his head and tried to maintain his composure. Judge, from the start of this trial, the defense has relied on trickery and deception to... Mr. Golance, the judge interrupted. Don't say something you can't back up and that will get you in trouble. This witness, just like the first one Mr. Haller called, has been on this list for 2 weeks. Right there, in black and white. You had every opportunity to find out what these people were going to say. If you didn't take that opportunity, then that was your decision. But this is not trickery or deception. You better watch yourself. Golant stood with his head bowed for a moment before speaking. Your Honor, the state requests a brief recess, he finally said in a quiet voice. How brief? Until 1 o'clock. I wouldn't call 2 hours brief, Mr. Golance. Your Honor, I cut in. I object to any recess. He just wants to grab my witness and turn his testimony. Now that I object to, Golance said.
Look, no recess, no delay, and no more bickering, the judge said. We've already lost most of the morning. Objection overruled. Step back.
We returned to our places, and I played a 30-second cut of the video showing the handcuffed man being placed in the back of the 4 Alpha car at Malibu Creek State Park. I froze the image in the same spot as before, just as the car was speeding by the camera. I left it on the screen as I continued my direct examination.
Deputy Stallworth, is that you driving that car?
Yes, it is.
Who is the man in the back seat?
His name is Eli Wims.
I noticed that he was handcuffed before being placed in the car. Is that because he was under arrest?
Yes, he was.
What was he arrested for?
For trying to kill me, for one. He was also charged with unlawful discharge of a weapon.
How many counts of unlawful discharge of a weapon?
I can't recall the exact number.
How about 94?
That sounds about right. It was a lot. He shot the place up out there.
Stallworth was tired and subdued, but unhesitant in his answers. He had no idea how they fit into the Elliott case and didn't seem to care about trying to protect the prosecution with short, non-responsive answers. He was probably mad at Golentz for not getting him out of testifying.
So you arrested him and took him to the nearby Malibu station?
No, I transported him all the way to the county jail in downtown, where he could be placed on the psych level.
How long did that take? The drive, I mean.
About an hour.
And then you drove back to Malibu?
No. First I had 4 Alpha repaired. Wims had fired a shot that took out the side lamp. While I was downtown, I went to the motor pool and had it replaced. That took up the rest of my shift.
So when did the car return to Malibu?
At shift change. I turned it over to the day watch guys.
I looked down at my notes. That would have been deputies Murray and Harbor.
That's right.
Stallworth yawned, and there was murmured laughter in the courtroom.
I know we have you past your bedtime, deputy. I won't take too much longer.
When you turn the car over from shift to shift, do you clean it out or disinfect the car in any way?
You're supposed to. Realistically, unless you've got puke in the back seat, nobody does that. The cars get taken out of rotation once or twice a week, and the motor guys clean them up.
Did Eli Wims puke in your car?
No, I would have known.
More murmured laughter. I looked down from the lectern at Golentz, and he wasn't smiling at all.
Okay, Deputy Stallworth, let me see if I got this right. Eli Wims was arrested for shooting at you and firing at least 93 other shots that morning. He was arrested, his hands were cuffed behind his back, and he was transported by you downtown. Do I have all of that right?
Sounds right to me.
In the video, Mr. Wims can be seen in the rear passenger side seat. Did he stay there for the whole hour-long ride downtown?
Yes, he did. I had him belted in.
Is it standard procedure to place someone who is in custody on the passenger side?
Yes, it is. You don't want him behind you when you're driving.
Deputy, I also noticed on the tape that you did not place Mr. Wims' hands in plastic bags or anything of that nature before placing him in your patrol car. Why is that?
Didn't think it was necessary.
Why?
Because it was not going to be an issue. The evidence was overwhelming that he had fired the weapons in his possession. We weren't worried about gunshot residue.
Thank you, Deputy Stallworth. I hope you can go get some sleep now. I sat down and left the witness for Golentz. He slowly got up and took the lectern. He knew exactly where I was going now, but there was little he was going to be able to do to stop me. But I had to give him credit. He found a small crack in my direct and tried his best to exploit it.
Deputy Stallworth, approximately how long did you wait for your car to be repaired at the downtown motor hub?
About 2 hours. They only have a couple guys work midnight watch, and they were juggling jobs down there.
Did you stay with the car for those 2 hours?
No, I grabbed a desk in the office and wrote up the arrest report on Wims.
And you testified earlier that no matter what the procedure is supposed to be, you generally rely on the motor pool to keep the fleet cars clean. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
Do you make a formal request, or do people working in the motor hub just take it upon themselves to clean and maintain the car?
I've never made a formal request. It just gets done, I guess.
Now, during those 2 hours that you were away from the car and writing the report,
Do you know if the employees in the motor hub cleaned or disinfected the car?
No, I do not.
They could have, and you wouldn't necessarily know about it, right?
Right.
Thank you, Deputy.
I hesitated, but got up for redirect.
Deputy Stallworth, you said it took them 2 hours to repair the car because they were short-handed and busy, correct?
Correct.
He said it in a boy am I getting tired of this tone. So it is unlikely that these guys would have taken the time to clean your car if you didn't ask, right?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them.
Did you specifically ask them to clean the car?
Nope.
Thank you, Deputy. I sat down, and Golance passed on another round. It was now almost noon. The judge adjourned for lunch, but gave the jury and lawyers only a 45-minute break, as he sought to make up for lost time during the morning. That was fine with me. My star witness was next, and the sooner I got her on the stand, the closer my client was going to be to a verdict of acquittal. Dr. Shyamaram Arslanian was a surprise witness. Not in terms of her presence at the trial, she had been on the witness list longer than I had been on the case, but in terms of her physical appearance and personality. Her name and pedigree in forensics conjured an image of a woman deep, dark, and scientific, a white lab coat and hair ironed back in a knot, but she was none of that. She was a vivacious, blue-eyed blonde, with a cheerful disposition and easy smile. She wasn't just photogenic, she was telegenic. She was articulate and confident, but never came close to being arrogant. The one-word description for her was the one-word description every lawyer wants for every one of his witnesses: likable. And it was rare to get that in a witness delivering your forensic case. I had spent most of the weekend with Shammy, as she preferred to be called. We had gone over the gunshot residue evidence in the Elliott case and the testimony she would give for the defense, as well as the cross-examination she could expect to receive from Golance. This had been delayed until so late in the game to avoid discovery issues. What my expert didn't know, she couldn't reveal to the prosecutor. So she was kept in the dark about the magic bullet until the last possible moment. There was no doubt that she was a celebrity gun for hire. She had once hosted a show about her own exploits on Court TV. She was asked twice for her autograph when I took her to dinner at the Palm, and was on a first-name basis with a couple of TV execs who visited the table. She charged a celebrity-level fee as well. For 4 days in Los Angeles, to study, prepare, and testify, she would receive a flat rate of $10,000 plus expenses. Nice work if you could get it, and she could. She was known to study the many requests for her time, and to choose only those in which she steadfastly believed there had been a grievous error committed, or a miscarriage of justice. It also didn't hurt if you had a case that was getting the attention of the national media. I knew, after spending the first 10 minutes with her, that she was going to be worth every penny Elliott would pay her. She would be double trouble for the prosecution. Her personality was going to win over the jury, and her facts were going to seal the deal. So much of trial work comes down to who is testifying, not what the testimony actually reveals. It's about selling your case to the jury, and Shammy could have sold ice to an Eskimo. The state's forensic witness was a lab geek with a personality of a test tube. My witness had hosted a television show called Chemically Dependent. I heard the low hum of recognition in the courtroom as my big-haired witness made her entrance from the back, holding all eyes as she walked up the center aisle, through the gate, and across the proving grounds to the witness stand. She wore a navy blue suit that fit her curves snugly and accentuated the cascade of blonde curls over her shoulders. Even Judge Stanton seemed infatuated. He asked the courtroom deputy to get her a glass of water before she had even taken the oath. He hadn't asked the state's forensic geek if he wanted jack shit. After she gave her name and spelled it and took the oath to tell nothing but the truth, I got up with my legal pad and went to the lectern. Good afternoon, Dr. Arslanian. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thanks for asking.
There was a slight trace of a southern accent in her voice. Before we go over your curriculum vitae, I want to get something out of the way up front. You are a paid consultant to the defense, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I'm paid to be here, not paid to testify to anything other than my own opinion, whether it's in line with the defense or not. That's my deal, and I never change it.
Okay, tell us where you were from, Doctor.
I live in Ossining, New York, right now. I was born and raised in Florida and spent a lot of years in the Boston area, going to different schools here and there.
Shamiram Arslanian. That doesn't sound like a Florida name.
She smiled brilliantly. My father is 100% Armenian, so I guess that makes me half Armenian and half Floridian. My father said I was Armageddon when I was a girl.
Many in the courtroom chuckled politely. What is your background in forensic sciences? I asked.
Well, I got two related degrees. I got my master's at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and that is in chemical engineering. I then got a PhD in criminology, and that was awarded to me from John Jay College in New York.
When you say awarded, does that mean it's an honorary degree?
Hell no, she said forcefully. I worked my butt off 2 years to get that sucker.
This time, laughter broke out across the courtroom, and I noticed that even the judge smiled before politely tapping his gavel one time for order. I saw in your resume that you have 2 undergraduate degrees as well. Is that true?
I've got 2 of everything, it seems. 2 kids, 2 cars. I've even got 2 cats at home, named Wilbur and Orville.
I glanced over at the prosecution table and saw that Golentz and his second were staring straight forward and had not so much as cracked a smile. I then checked the jury and saw all 24 eyes holding on my witness with rapt attention. She had them eating out of her hand, and she hadn't even started yet. What are your undergraduate degrees?
I got 1 from Harvard in engineering and 1 from the Berklee College of Music. I went to both schools at the same time.
You have a music degree, I said with feigned surprise.
I like to sing.
More laughter. The hits kept coming, one surprise after another. Shami Arslanian was the perfect witness. Golentz finally stood and addressed the judge.
Your Honor, the state would ask that the witness provide testimony regarding forensics and not music or pet names or things not germane to the serious nature of this trial.
The judge grudgingly asked me to keep my examination on point. Golentz sat down. He had won the point, but lost the position. Everybody in the room now viewed him as a spoilsport, stealing what little levity there was in such a serious matter. I asked a few more questions, which revealed that Dr. Arslanian currently worked as a teacher and researcher at John Jay. I covered her history and limited availability as an expert witness, and finally brought her testimony to her study of the gunshot residue found on Walter Elliott's body and clothing on the day of the murders in Malibu. She testified that she reviewed the procedures and results of the sheriff's lab and conducted her own evaluations and modeling. She said she also reviewed all videotapes submitted to her by the defense in conjunction with her studies. Now, Dr. Arslanian, the state's forensic witness testified earlier in this trial that the tabs wiped on Mr. Elliott's hands and sleeves and jacket tested positive for elevated levels of certain elements associated with gunshot residue. Do you agree with that conclusion?
Yes, I do, my witness said.
A low vibration of surprise rolled through the room.
You are saying that your studies concluded that the defendant had gunshot residue on his hands and clothes.
That is correct. Elevated levels of barium, antimony, and lead. In combination, these are indications of gunshot residue.
What does elevated levels mean?
It just means that some of these materials you would find on a person's body, whether they had fired or handled a weapon or not, just from everyday life.
So it is elevated levels of all 3 materials that are required for a positive result in gunshot residue testing, correct?
Yes, that and concentration patterns.
Can you explain what you mean by concentration patterns?
Sure. When a gun discharges, in this case we think we're talking about a handgun, there is an explosion in the chamber that gives the bullet its energy and velocity. That explosion sends gases out the barrel with the bullet as well as any little crack and opening in the gun. The breech, that is the part at the rear of the gun's barrel, comes open after a shot has been fired. The escaping gases propel these microscopic elements we're talking about backward onto the shooter.
and that's what happened in this case, correct?
No, not correct. Based on the totality of my investigation, I cannot say that.
I raised my eyebrows in feigned surprise.
But doctor, you just said you agreed with the state's conclusion that there was gunshot residue on the defendant's hands and sleeves.
I do agree with the state's conclusion that there was GSR on the defendant, but that wasn't the question you asked.
I took a moment as if to retrace my question.
Dr. Arslanian, are you saying that there could be an alternate explanation for the gunshot residue on Mr. Elliot?
Yes, I am.
We were there. We had finally arrived at the crux of the defense's case. It was time to shoot the magic bullet.
Did your study of the materials provided to you over the weekend by the defense lead you to an alternate explanation for the gunshot residue on Walter Elliott's hands and clothing?
Yes, they did.
And what is that explanation?
It is very highly likely, in my opinion, that the residue on Mr. Elliott's hands and clothes was transferred there.
Transferred? Are you suggesting someone intentionally planted GSR on him?
No, I am not. I am suggesting that it occurred inadvertently, by happenstance or mistake. Gunshot residue is basically microscopic dust. It moves. It can be transferred by contact.
What does transferred by contact mean?
It means the material we are talking about lights on a surface after it is discharged from the firearm. If that surface comes into contact with another, some of the material will transfer.
It will rub off, is what I'm saying.
This is why there are law enforcement protocols for safeguarding against this. The victims and suspects in gun crimes often have their clothes removed for preservation and study. Some agencies put evidence bags over people's hands to preserve and guard against transference.
Can this material be transferred more than once?
Yes, it can, with depreciating levels. This is a solid material. It's not a gas. It doesn't dissipate like a gas. It is microscopic, but solid, and it has to be someplace at the end of the day. I've conducted numerous studies of this and found that transference can repeat and repeat.
But in the case of repeated transference, wouldn't the amount of material depreciate with each transfer until negligible?
That's right. Each new surface will hold less than the prior surface. So it's all a matter of how much you start with. The more you start with, the greater the amount that can be transferred.
I nodded and took a small break by flipping up pages on my pad as if I were looking for something. I wanted there to be a clear line between the discussion of theory and the specific case at hand.
Okay, doctor, I finally said. With these theories in mind, can you tell us what happened in the Elliott case?
I can tell you and show you, Dr. Arslanian said. When Mr. Elliott was handcuffed and placed in the back of the 4 Alpha patrol car, he was literally placed in a hotbed of gunshot residue. That is where and when the transference took place.
How so?
His hands, arms, and clothing were placed in direct contact with gunshot residue from another case. Transfer to him would have been inevitable.
Golentz quickly objected, saying I had not laid the groundwork for such an answer. I told the judge I intended to do that right now and asked permission to set the video equipment up in front of the jury again.
Dr. Arslanian had taken the video shot by my first witness, Julio Muniz, and edited it into one demonstration video. I introduced it as a defense exhibit over Golentz's failed objection. Using it as a visual aid, I carefully walked my witness through the defense's theory of transference. It was a demonstration that took nearly an hour and was one of the most thorough presentations of alternate theory I had ever been involved in. We started with Eli Wims's arrest and his placement in the back seat of the Alpha car. We then cut to Elliot being placed in the same patrol car less than 10 hours later. The same car and the same seat. Both men's hands cuffed behind their backs. She was stunningly authoritative in her conclusion. A man who had fired weapons at least 94 times was placed in that seat, she said. 94 times? He would have literally been reeking of gunshot residue.
And is it your expert opinion that gunshot residue would have transferred from Eli Wims to that car seat? I asked.
Most definitely.
And is it your expert opinion that the gunshot residue on that seat could then have been transferred to the next person who sat there?
Yes, it is.
And is it your expert opinion that this was the origin of the gunshot residue on Walter Elliott's hands and clothes?
Again, with his hands behind his back like that, he came in direct contact with a transfer surface. Yes, in my expert opinion, I do believe that this is how he got the gunshot residue on his hands and clothes.
I paused again to drive home the expert's conclusions. If I knew anything about reasonable doubt, I knew I had just embedded it in every juror's consciousness. Whether they would later vote their conscience was another matter.
It was now time to bring in the big prop to drive Dr. Arslanian's testimony home. Doctor, did you draw any other conclusions from your analysis of the GSR evidence that supported the theory of transference you have outlined here?
Yes, I did.
And what was that?
Can I use my mannequin to demonstrate?
I asked the judge for permission to allow the witness to use a mannequin for demonstration purposes, and he granted it without objection from Golan's. I then stepped through the clerk's corral to the hallway leading to the judge's chambers. I had left Dr. Arslanian's mannequin here until it had been ruled admissible. I wheeled it out to the center of the proving grounds in front of the jury and the court TV camera. I signaled to Dr. Arslanian to come down from the witness stand to make her demonstration. The mannequin was a full-body model with fully manipulating limbs, hands, and even fingers. It was made of white plastic and had several smudges of gray on its face and hands from experiments and demonstrations conducted over the years. It was dressed in blue jeans and a dark blue collared shirt beneath a windbreaker with a design on the back commemorating a University of Florida national football championship earlier in the year. The mannequin was suspended 2 inches off the ground on a metal brace and wheeled platform. I realized I'd forgotten something and went over to my rolling bag. I quickly pulled out the wooden dummy gun and collapsing pointer. I handed them both to Dr. Arslanian and then went back to the lectern.
Okay, what do we have here, Doctor?
This is Manny, my demonstration mannequin. Manny, this is the jury.
There was a bit of laughter, and one juror, the lawyer, even nodded his hello to the dummy.
Manny's a Florida Gator fan?
He is today.
Sometimes the messenger can obscure the message. With some witnesses, you want that, because their testimony isn't all that helpful. But that was not the case with Dr. Arslanian. I knew I had been walking a tightrope with her. Too cute and entertaining on one side, solid scientific evidence on the other. The proper balance would make her and her information leave the strongest impression on the jury. I knew it was now time to get back to serious testimony.
Why do we need Manny here, Doctor?
Because an analysis of the SEMS tabs collected by the sheriff's forensic expert can show us why the gunshot residue on Mr. Elliott did not come from his firing of a weapon.
I know the state's expert explained these procedures to us last week, but I would like you to refresh us. What is a SEMS tab?
The GSR test is conducted with round tabs or discs that have a peel-off sticky side. The tabs are padded on the area to be tested, and they collect all the microscopic material on the surface. The tab then goes into a scanning electron microscope, or SEMS, as we call it. Through the microscope, we see or don't see the three elements we have been talking about here: barium, antimony, and lead.
Okay, then, do you have a demonstration for us?
Yes, I do.
Please explain it to the jury. Dr. Arslanian extended her pointer and faced the jury. Her demonstration had been carefully planned and rehearsed, right down to my always referring to her as doctor and her always referring to the state's forensic man as mister.
Mr. Guilfoyle, the sheriff's department forensic expert, took 8 different samples from Mr. Elliott's body and clothes. Each tab was coded so that the location it sampled would be known and charted.
She used the pointer on the mannequin as she discussed the locations of the samples. The mannequin stood with its arms down at its sides.
Tab A was the top of the right hand. Tab B was the top of the left hand. Tab C was the right sleeve of Mr. Elliott's windbreaker, and D was the left sleeve. Then we have tabs E and F being the right and left front panels of the jacket, and G and H being the chest and torso portions of the shirt Mr. Elliott wore beneath the open jacket.
Are these the clothes he was wearing that day?
No, they are not.
These are exact duplicates of what he was wearing, right down to the size and manufacturer.
Okay, what did you learn from your analysis of the 8 tabs?
I've prepared a chart for the jurors so they can follow along.
I presented the chart as a defense exhibit. Golentz had been given a copy of it that morning. He now stood and objected, saying his late receipt of the chart violated the rules of discovery. I told the judge the chart had only been composed the night before, after my meetings with Dr. Arslanian on Saturday and Sunday. The judge agreed with the prosecutor, saying that the direction of my examination of the witness was obvious and well-prepared, and that I therefore should have drawn the chart sooner. The objection was sustained, and Dr. Arslanian now had to wing it on her own. It had been a gamble, but I didn't regret the move. I would rather have my witness talking to the jurors without a net than have had Golentz in possession of my strategy in advance of its implementation. Okay, doctor, you can still refer to your notes in the chart. The jurors just need to follow along. What did you learn from your analysis of the 8 SEMS tabs?
I learned that the levels of gunshot residue on the different tabs greatly differed.
How so?
Well, tabs A and B, which came from Mr. Elliott's hands, were where the highest levels of GSR were found. From there, we get a steep drop-off in the GSR levels. Tabs C, D, E, and F, with much lower levels, and no GSR reading at all on tabs G and H.
Again, she used the pointer to illustrate. What did that tell you, doctor?
That the GSR on Mr. Elliott's hands and clothes did not come from firing a weapon.
Can you illustrate why?
First, comparable readings coming from both hands indicate that the weapon was fired in a two-handed grip. The different tabs greatly differed.
How so?
Well, tabs A and B, which came from Mr. Elliott's hands, were where the highest levels of GSR were found. From there, we get a steep drop-off in the GSR levels. Tabs C, D, E, and F, with much lower levels, and no GSR reading at all on tabs G and H.
Again, she used the pointer to illustrate. What did that tell you, doctor?
That the GSR on Mr. Elliott's hands and clothes did not come from firing a weapon.
Can you illustrate why?
First, comparable readings coming from both hands indicate that the weapon was fired in a two-handed grip.
She went to the mannequin and raised its arms, forming.
Well, tabs A and B, which came from Mr. Elliott's hands, were where the highest levels of GSR were found. From there, we get a steep drop-off in the GSR levels. Tabs C, D, E, and F, with much lower levels, and no GSR reading at all on tabs G and H.
Again, she used the pointer to illustrate. What did that tell you, doctor?
That the GSR on Mr. Elliott's hands and clothes did not come from firing a weapon.
Can you illustrate why?
First, comparable readings coming from both hands indicate that the weapon was fired in a two-handed grip.
She went to the mannequin and raised its arms.
B, which came from Mr. Elliott's hands, were where the highest levels of GSR were found. From there, we get a steep drop-off in the GSR levels. Tabs C, D, E, and F, with much lower levels, and no GSR reading at all on tabs G and H.
Again, she used the pointer to illustrate. What did that tell you, doctor?
That the GSR on Mr. Elliott's hands and clothes did not come from firing a weapon.
Can you illustrate why?
First, comparable readings coming from both hands indicate that the weapon was fired in a two-handed grip.
She went to the mannequin and raised its arms, forming a V by pulling the hands together out front. She bent the hands and fingers of the GSR were found.
From there, we get a steep drop-off in the GSR levels. Tab C.
After the jury and the judge had vacated the courtroom and the observers were pushing out into the hallway, I sauntered over to the prosecutor's table. Golentz was writing out questions on a legal pad. He didn't look up at me.
What?
He said. The answer's no.
To what question?
The one you were going to ask about my client taking a plea agreement. We're not interested. Golentz smirked.
You're funny, Holler. So what? You've got an impressive witness. The trial's a long way from over.
And I've got a French police captain who's going to testify tomorrow that Riltz ratted out 7 of the most dangerous, vindictive men he's ever investigated. 2 of them happened to get out of prison last year, and they disappeared. Nobody knows where they are.
Maybe they were in Malibu last spring.
Golens put his pen down and finally looked up at me.
Yeah, I talked to your Inspector Clouseau yesterday. It's pretty clear he's saying whatever you want him to say, as long as you fly him first class. At the end of the depot, he pulled out one of those star maps and asked me if I could show him where Angelina Jolie lives. He's one serious witness you came up with.
I had told Captain Pepin to cool it with the star map stuff. He apparently hadn't listened. I needed to change the subject.
So, where are the Germans? I asked.
Golens checked behind him, as if to make sure Johann Rilts's family members weren't there.
I told them that they had to be prepared for your strategy of building a defense by shitting all over the memory of their son and brother, he said. I told them you were going to take Johann's problems in France 5 years ago and use them to try to get his killer off. I told them that you were going to depict him as a German gigolo who seduced rich clients, men and women, all over Malibu and the West Side. You know what the father said to me?
No, but you'll tell me.
He said that they'd had enough of American justice and were going back home.
I tried to retort with a clever and cynical comeback line, but I came up empty.
Don't worry, Golens said. Up or down, I'll call them and tell them the verdict.
Good. I left him there and went out into the hallway to look for my client. I saw him in the center of a ring of reporters. Feeling cocky after the success of Dr. Oslanian's testimony, he was now working the big jury, public opinion.
All this time they've concentrated on coming after me. The real killer's been out there running around free.
A nice, concise soundbite. He was good. I was about to push through the crowd to grab him when Dennis Wojciechowski intercepted me first.
Come with me, he said.
We walked down the hallway away from the crowd.
What's up, Sisko? I was wondering where you've been.
I've been busy. I got the report from Florida. Do you want to hear it?
I had told him what Elliot had told me about fronting for the so-called organization. Elliot's story had seemed sincere enough, but in the light of day, I reminded myself of a simple truism. Everybody lies. And told Sisko to see what he could do about confirming it.
Give it to me, I said.
I used a PI in Fort Lauderdale, who I've worked with before. Tampa's on the other side of the state, but I wanted to go with a guy I knew and trusted.
I understand. What did he come up with?
Elliot's grandfather founded a phosphate shipping operation 78 years ago. He worked it, then Elliot's father worked it, and then Elliot himself worked it. Only he didn't like getting his hands dirty in the phosphate business, and he sold it a year after his father died of a heart attack. It was a privately owned company, so the record of the sale is not public. Newspaper articles at the time put the sale at about $32 million.
What about organized crime?
My guy couldn't find a whiff of it. Looked to him like it was a good, clean operation. Legally, that is. Elliot told you he was a front and he was sent out here to invest their money. He didn't say anything about him selling his own company and bringing the money out here. The man's lying to you.
I nodded. Okay, Sisko, thanks.
You need me in court? I got a few things I'm still working on. I heard juror number 7 went missing this morning.
Yeah, he's in the wind, and I don't need you in court.
Okay, man, I'll talk to you.
He headed off toward the elevators, and I was left to stare at my client holding forth with the reporters. A slow burn started in me, and it gained heat as I waded into the crowd to get to him.
Okay, that's all, people, I said. No further comment, no further comment.
I grabbed Elliot by the arm, pulled him out of the crowd, and walked him down the hall. I shooed a couple trailing reporters away until we were finally far enough from all other ears and could speak privately.
Walter, what were you doing?
He was smiling gleefully. He made a fist and pumped it into the air.
Sticking it up their asses! The prosecutor and the sheriffs, all of them!
Yeah, well, you better wait on that. We still got a ways to go. We may have won the day, but we haven't won the war yet.
Aw, come on! It's in the bag, Mick! She was fucking outstanding in there! I mean, I want to marry her!
Yeah, that's nice, but let's see how she does on cross before you buy the ring, okay?
Another reporter came up, and I told her to take a hike, then turn back to my client.
Listen, Walter, we need to talk.
Okay, talk.
I had a private investigator check your story out in Florida,
and I just found out it was bullshit. You lied to me, Walter, and I told you never to lie to me.
Elliot shook his head and looked annoyed with me for taking the wind out of his sails.
To him, being caught in the lie was a minor inconvenience, an annoyance that I would even bring it up.
Why did you lie to me, Walter? Why'd you spin that story?
He shrugged and looked away from me when he spoke.
The story? I read it in a script once. I turned the project down, actually, but I remembered the story.
But why? I'm your lawyer. You can tell me anything. I asked you to tell me the truth, and you lied to me. Why?
He finally looked me in the eyes. I knew I had to light a fire under you.
What fire? What are you talking about?
Come on, Mickey. That's not...
He was turning to go back to the...
grabbed him roughly by the arm.
No.
Here. What fire did you light? What fire did you light?
Everybody's going back in. The break is over and we should be in there.
I gripped him even harder. What fire, Walter?
You're hurting my arm.
I relaxed my grip, but didn't let go. And I didn't take my eyes off his. What fire?
He looked away from me and put an aw shucks grin on his face. I finally let go of his arm.
Look, he said. From the start, I needed you to believe I didn't do it. It was the only way for me to know you would bring your best game. That you would be goddamn relentless.
I stared at him and saw the smile become a look of pride.
I told you I could read people, Mick. I knew you needed something to believe in. I knew if I was a little bit guilty, but not guilty of the big crime, then it would give you what you needed. It would give you your fire back.
They say the best actors in Hollywood are on the wrong side of the camera. At that moment, I knew that was true. I knew that Elliot had killed his wife and her lover, and was even proud of it. I found my voice and spoke.
Where'd you get the gun?
Oh, I'd had it. Bought it under the table at some flea market back in the 70s. I was a big Dirty Harry fan, and I wanted a 44 mag. I kept it out of the beach house for protection. You know, a lot of drifters down on the beach.
What really happened in that house, Walter?
He nodded like it was his plan all along to take this moment to tell me.
What happened was I went out there to confront her and whoever she was fucking every Monday like clockwork. But when I got there, I realized it was Riltz. She'd passed him off in front of me as a faggot, had him to dinners and parties and premieres with us, and they probably laughed all about it later. Laughed about me, Mick. It got me mad. Enraged, actually. I got the gun out of the cabinet, put on rubber gloves from under the sink, and I went upstairs.
You should have seen the look on their faces when they saw that big gun.
I stared at him for a long moment. I'd had clients confess to me before, but usually they were crying, wringing their hands, battling the demons their crimes had created inside. But not Walter Elliot. He was cold to the bone.
How'd you get rid of the gun?
I hadn't gone out there alone. I had somebody with me, and they took the gun, the gloves, and my first set of clothes, then walked down the beach, got back up to the PCH and caught a cab. Meantime, I washed up and changed, then I dialed 911.
Who was it that helped you?
You don't need to know that.
I nodded. Not because I agreed with him. I nodded because I already knew.
I had a flash vision of Nina Albrecht easily unlocking the door to the deck when I couldn't figure it out. It showed a familiarity with her boss's bedroom that had struck me the moment I saw it. I looked away from my client and down at the floor. It had been scuffed by a million people who had trod a million miles for justice.
I never counted on the transference, Mick. When they said they wanted to do the test, I was all for it. I thought I was clean, and they would see that and it would be the end of it. No gun, no residue, no case.
He shook his head at such a close call.
Thank God for lawyers like you.
I jerked my eyes up to his.
Did you kill Jerry Vincent?
Elliot looked me in the eye and shook his head.
No, I didn't. But it was a lucky break, because I ended up with a better lawyer.
I didn't know how to respond. I looked down the hall to the courtroom door. The deputy was there. He waved to me
and signaled me into the courtroom. The break was over and the judge was ready to start. I nodded and held up one finger. Wait. I knew the judge wouldn't take the bench until he was told the lawyers were in place. Go back in, I said to Elliot. I have to use the restroom. Elliot calmly walked toward the waiting deputy. I quickly stepped into the nearby restroom and went to one of the sinks. I splashed cold water on my face, spotting my best suit and shirt, but not caring at all. That night, I sent Patrick to the movies because I wanted the house to myself. I wanted no television or conversation. I wanted no interruption and no one watching me. I called Bosch and told him I was in for the night. It was not so that I could prepare for what likely would be the last day of the trial. I was more than ready for that. I had the French police captain primed and ready to deliver another dose of reasonable doubt to the jury. And it was not because I now knew that my client was guilty. I could count the truly innocent clients I'd had over the years on one hand. Guilty people were my specialty. But I was feeling bruised because I'd been used so well, and because I'd forgotten the basic rule, everybody lies. And I was feeling bruised because I knew that I, too, was guilty. I could not stop thinking about Rilts's father and brothers, about what they had told Golentz about their decision to go home. They were not waiting to see the verdict, if it first meant seeing their dead loved one dragged through the sewers of the American justice system. I had spent the good part of 20 years defending guilty and sometimes evil men. I had always been able to accept that and deal with it, but I didn't feel very good about myself or the work that I would perform the next day. It was in these moments that I felt the strongest desire to return to old ways, to find that distance.